don't meddle so dangerously. The only people of authority we can rely on are officials from our own embassy or consulate. We shouldn't seek cooperation from anybody else, he said.
I totally agree with my colleague, said Hikmet Bey.
Farid had considered asking the organization to assist, using its own people who were planted all over the place, but he decided not to persist with this line of argument. He was content simply to say,
I can see you're warming to the idea of traveling through Berlin and down from there.
Hikmet Özdoğan responded,
Ferit Bey, my friend, we're not the ones in danger. If the real identities of some of the passengers are discovered, they'll be given hell. We have to be careful not to jeopardize their lives. Say we do manage to convince the authorities that the youngsters on board are Turkish students. What about the professors, doctors, and scientists that the Germans are really after? How are you going to get them through Berlin? Will they wear some sort of disguise or what?
Of course, replied Ferit. Do you think that it's hard to change people's identities? Those who are bald will be given wigs. Those with curly hair and mustaches will shave them off. Others can wear glasses or dye their hair, and others might even pluck their eyebrows.
This is turning into a circus carriage, said Hikmet Özdoğan.
Hikmet Bey, as we said before, let's sleep on it. We might see things more clearly in the morning, Tarık said in his calmest voice.
Fine, but let's not dither. We've got to make the final decision tomorrow. The train should be arriving in a few days, and remember, we can't keep it waiting for more than one night.
So, here again tomorrow after work? Asked Ferit.
Unfortunately not, replied Hikmet Bey. My wife and daughter will be here tomorrow morning.
My apartment is full to the brim, said Ferit. There's no room to stand, let alone sit.
And Mulis will be in my apartment. He's got a general idea of what's going on, but since we're trying to keep this on a need-to-know basis, the fewer people that know any details, the better.
What about meeting at the consulate, then?
There'll be the night guard and the duty clerk.
I know, said Tarık. There's a friend of mine who's traveling on the train. She lives on her own. We can go to her apartment. She doesn't speak much Turkish anyway. I can ask her to go to the cinema or something.
Is this friend Margot by any chance?
Ferit whispered, leaning toward Tarık's ear. Yes?
Killing two birds with one stone, eh?
I thought you were my friend.
I certainly am, said Ferit. But I love teasing you.
All the same, there are limits.
What on earth are you whispering about? Said Hikmet Özdoğan. Is there something you're keeping from us?
No, not at all, Hikmet Bey. We're just talking about our meeting place for tomorrow. I'll get in touch with my friend and let you all know, said Tarık. He took the map off the wall and rolled it up.
I still say it will be dangerous for the train to pass through Berlin,
Hikmet Özdoğan repeated.
Something tells me the opposite. Mark my words.
And don't forget my pregnant wife will be on board too. Would I want to put my wife and unborn child in danger?
Replied Ferit. In any case, our ambassadors in Berlin and Vichy have the final word.
Not necessarily. They're expecting us to weigh all the pros and cons and reach our own decision.
Hikmet Bey, the final decision carries a lot of responsibility. By the way, it's not prudent to discuss this over the telephone. I'm seriously thinking of going to Vichy early tomorrow morning. Why don't you come too? Asked Tarık.
It's not right for both of us to be out of the consulate. You'd better go alone. I'll send a coded message to Safet Arukan in Berlin.
Hikmet Özdoğan replied. As they walked toward Tarık's car, Ferit asked,
Your colleague seems very apprehensive, doesn't he?
Not particularly. He's a very cautious man who wants to carry out his duties to the best of his abilities, replied Tarık. Working for the government involves a lot of responsibility. You can't act on instinct or your own preference. One has to consider every minute detail carefully.
God save me from any governmental job that might stifle my creativity, said Ferit.
Farewell evening. When Margot returned from the cinema, the meeting in her apartment was over. Taruk was in the sitting room sipping his wine. When he heard Margot's key in the door, he rushed to the kitchen and returned with another glass. "So how was the film? I hope you enjoyed it," he said, offering her a glass of wine.
"I saw two films, one after the other, so I wouldn't disturb your meeting."
"Here's your reward for being such a good, understanding girl. I remember that you liked this wine very much when we first went out to dinner." He made a toast, raising his glass. "Bon voyage! May you have a comfortable journey without any problems." Margot took a sip, placed her glass on the table, and put her arms around Taruk.
"Did you reach a decision?"
"Yes, we did. Do you want me to tell you, or should it be a surprise?"
"I'm petrified, Taruk. Please don't tell me we're going through Berlin."
"I'd better not tell you then."
"No! Are you telling me the truth?"
"What do you mean by that?"
"That we're going through Berlin?"
"Come here," he said, sitting her on his lap. He cradled her in his arms like a baby.
"Trust me, Margot. The safest way is through Berlin. We've debated the whole thing. We've asked others. We've even communicated with Turkey. Finally, even Hikmet Özduğan agreed that it's the best way." "Just thinking about it makes my hair stand on end."
"That's why it's the safest way. If even thinking about it gives you the creeps, who on earth would think that a train carrying so many Jews would dare to pass through Germany? Can't you see? This very thought is your security."
"No one could imagine such a thing."
"Exactly. That's what we're counting on. We're doing something even the devil himself wouldn't think of. Once they see that your passports have been stamped in Berlin, no German, Italian, or Austrian will bother you. From there, it will be plain sailing all the way to Kostenja."
"Weren't we going to Istanbul?"
"Most of the passengers will board a boat in Kostenja. Those continuing to Istanbul will be transferred to another train. The Alfandaris are going to Istanbul. You'd better stick with them."
"How long will this adventure last?"
"It's indeed an adventure. Nobody can tell. You'll have to take this one day at a time. Some tracks may have been bombed. Others may be disconnected. If that happens, you'll be diverted. Then, of course, you may be delayed in places where soldiers get on board to be transported."
"Could it take a year?"
Taruk laughed. "One can go around the world in 80 days. How could your journey take a year?"
"But there's a war on."
"Don't worry, Margot. I'm sure it will take between 10 and 20 days. You must send me a wire as soon as you arrive. Do you promise?" Margot started to cry quietly in Taruk's arms.
"Please don't cry, my baby. Don't forget you're not alone. You'll have your friends with you. The Alfandaris promised they will take care of you in Istanbul. Then, of course, there's Ferit and Evelyn.
Can you imagine that Ferit would let his pregnant wife board a train if it was that dangerous?"
"Taruk, that's not why I'm crying. It's strange that I don't feel like going now when I was so desperate before. I don't want to leave you, can't you see?"
Taruk kissed Margot all over her face and neck.
"I wish I could ask you to stay, my darling." "Why don't you then?"
"I can't, Margot. I have no right to ask you to waste the best years of your life. You're young and beautiful, and like all young women, you'll want to get married and have a family."
"I know you can't marry me unless you resign, Taruk."
"It hasn't been easy for me to get where I am. My father worked very hard to give me a good education. I can't tell you what he went through so that I could study in Istanbul. It wasn't just a matter of getting the money together for the school and boarding. They were also the books and my clothes. He took into account that I shouldn't look worse than my peers. Eventually, his heart couldn't take the strain. I'm where he wanted me to be, Margot. I couldn't possibly resign. To do that would be to disrespect his efforts and his memory."
"I wouldn't expect you to resign, Taruk. As for having children, well, What will be, will be.
Oh, my darling, you really don't realize. Having a child out of wedlock, or not being able to give your son your family name, is considered a fate worse than death in Anatolia. You may not necessarily feel that way now, but believe me, in a few years' time, you'll want what every young woman does, and then you'll blame me. No, Margot, we shouldn't do this to each other.
In that case, let's make the best of tonight.
Yes, let's. Let's make tonight our very own, our own special night, beautiful, precious, and emotional. The night I'll remember as long as I live.
Taruk lifted her from his lap and gently put her down on the carpet. He started kissing and undressing her tenderly. He removed her clothes piece by piece, breathing in the scent of her body, gazing in awe at her slender, pale form on the dark blue carpet, as though she were a Goya masterpiece. He wanted this picture, this image of this beautiful blonde woman eagerly and lovingly abandoning herself to him, to settle in his mind forever, erasing the image of the other blonde woman imprinted there. Ankara. Majit was so surprised by the telephone call he had just received, he was still holding the receiver and looking around the room for his colleague. He was alone. Only his secretary was in the adjoining office, and he preferred not to discuss the news with her until it had been confirmed. He put the receiver down and walked into her office.
Medya Hanım, I'm going to Husnu Bey's office. Let me know immediately if there are any calls.
Just as he turned to leave, he came face to face with Husnu. They went back into Majid's office and he closed the door.
Is this true? Asked Husnu.
I just heard it myself. I was on my way to your office to ask the same question.
When did it happen?
Von Papen, the German ambassador, asked for an appointment to see our foreign minister, Numan Bey, at 11 o'clock this morning. He arrived right on time and went straight up to see him.
Their meeting lasted about 20 minutes. I didn't see Von Papen leave, but those who did said he had a very long face. At about 1 o'clock, the Prime Minister telephoned Numan Bey and asked to see him before the lunch break ended. I realized something strange was happening, but I never thought it would end in a resignation.
Obviously it did.
Husnu, I suggest we keep this under our hats for a while.
Maybe President Inonu will persuade Numan Bey to...
The Numan Bey I know will never change his mind if he has decided to resign.
I wonder if resigning was his idea, or if he was pushed, said Majid.
We'll find out soon enough. In the meantime, I will be at the Chancellery.
Be careful, Husnu. Don't discuss this with anyone. Everything might change.
Don't fret, Majid. Of course I understand that as the minister's pet, you don't want him to leave.
That's not true at all. I can't believe you said that. I'm a bureaucrat at heart. I got to where I am through years of hard work, not by favors.
Majid said angrily.
Don't be so touchy. I was only joking.
I was only telling you to hang fire for a while.
There's no point aggravating a situation that might change. After all, no one knows if the resignation will be withdrawn or not.
That's all. Do as you wish.
I said I'm sorry, didn't I? No need to prolong this any further. I'll be careful, I promise. I'm just as aware as you that it would be unwise to change horses midstream, especially when the stream is so turbulent. Inshallah, we have been misinformed. I'll find out the details.
I've got to deal with 2 separate delegations today, so I'm stuck here. If you do hear anything, let me know.
Majid said coldly. Majid was upset at both the foreign minister's resignation and his friend's insinuation. He sat at his desk trying to analyze some files, but he was unable to concentrate. The telephone rang continuously. Everyone wanted to discuss the same subject and offer their personal opinions. Majid asked his secretary not to interrupt his meetings with the delegations unless a call was urgent. The second meeting lasted much longer than expected, and when Majid left the room to go to the toilet, the secretary told him that Husnu Bey had called several times.
It was only toward the end of the day that Majid got around to going to Husnu's office. As soon as Majid saw the expression on Husnu's face, he knew the news he had received that morning was true. About an hour later, Majid was deep in thought as he walked home through the drizzling rain. Why couldn't things go well for him? Just as things were beginning to improve at home, now this problem at the ministry. If his dear mother were alive, she would certainly say,
"Let me lift the curse of the evil eye from you, my son."
Having almost reached the breaking point, his relationship with Sabiha had suddenly improved. He didn't know exactly what had caused this sudden change of heart, just as he never found out why she'd become so distant in the first place. But one thing was certain. That night when he returned home from Cairo, she had cuddled up to him in bed. Even though he didn't like to admit it, Majid felt that that know-it-all doctor had been good for his wife. Sabiha's relationship with Julia was better, too. At least she was making more of an effort to show an interest in her daughter. Majid couldn't believe his ears when Julia told him that she had been to the cinema with her mother. "Is that true?" he had asked Sabiha.
"Of course it's true,"
Julia interrupted.
"Auntie Humeda and Pelin came with us. We saw an Esther Williams film. Doesn't she swim beautifully, Daddy? I'd like to learn to swim like her."
"In the summer, my darling, when we go to Istanbul. You can practice when we are on the island."
"Won't I need a teacher?"
"What for? Your mother is an excellent swimmer. I'm sure she could teach you."
"Actually, I wish your Aunt Selva were here. She was much better than me. She could teach you really well,"
Sabiha said. Majid noticed his father-in-law, sitting opposite him at the table, looked quizzically when he heard Selva's name. At least it was a look of sadness now, rather than the anger of the past. They were able to talk about Selva quite comfortably now in his presence. When Majid reached Kuzulay, he turned toward Sarkarya Street. He stopped at the florist on the corner and bought some white carnations for his wife. When they got engaged, he'd promised to always buy her white flowers, saying, "Because you're pure and delicate like a white flower." That objectionable psychiatrist had certainly helped improve things at home. Since Dr. Sahir had accused him of neglecting his wife in favor of his heavy work schedule, Majid had realized that there were ways he could make things up that would mean a lot to her. On the way home with the flowers, Majid wondered why he had taken such a dislike to that doctor. The poor man hadn't really done anything wrong. On the contrary, he had tried to be helpful by insinuating that Sabiha's attitude might in fact be due to Majid's own negligence. Was it possible, then, that he might have been jealous because Sabiha spent so much time being naked in front of this man? Not really naked, of course. Nonetheless, Sabiha had told him,
"I feel naked in front of this doctor. He somehow manages to strip me of my inhibitions and look deep into my soul."
Majid suddenly felt uncomfortable, thinking that he might have been jealous of his wife. Who knew how angry Sabiha would be if she knew his thoughts? She'd certainly say,
"What the hell do you take me for?"
Majid quickened his step as his thoughts started racing. What was Sabiha doing all this time that she was on her own? Who was she seeing? Was there someone else in her life causing her to be distant? He stumbled and looked around. Had anyone noticed that he nearly fell just then? No, Ankara was full of tired people immersed in their own thoughts, going over their own problems while rushing home. Where had all these doubts suddenly come from? Why was he having these strange fantasies concerning his wife after so many years? Suddenly, his mood changed, and he felt warm inside despite the drizzling rain and the cold weather. He remembered how his wife had snuggled up to him the night he had returned from Cairo. The way she had rekindled the fire in his body when he felt her naked breasts rubbing against his chest. Her hot lips had filled him with desire, making him feel a passion he hadn't felt for ages. He'd been taken aback by the emotional intensity between them that night. Could it be that he had fallen in love all over again with this capricious and coy wife of his? When Majid got home, Fazl Reshat Pasha opened the door for him.
"You shouldn't have troubled yourself. Isn't Hajar at home?" he asked.
"No trouble at all. It's Hajar's day off today,"
his father-in-law answered.
"I was standing by the window waiting for Leman Hanum to come home, and I saw you arriving."
"Is Hulya with her?"
"No, Hulya went next door to play with her friend. I think Sabiha is in her room."
"What lovely flowers!
Are you going out this evening?"
"No, I just got them for us. I'd better get out of these wet clothes,"
Majid said, walking to his room. Sabiha was in her dressing gown with a towel wrapped around her head. She was sitting on her bed applying polish to her toenails and was surprised to see him.
"Good Lord, Majid, you're early. I didn't expect you yet."
Majid put the flowers on her lap.
"What's all this about?"
"They're for you."
Majid took the bottle of nail polish from his wife's hand and placed it on the bedside table. He then pulled her dressing gown off and pushed her down onto the pillows. Sabiha tried to resist. He pulled down her green knickers with one hand while trying to unbutton his trousers with the other.
"Majid, what are you doing? Mind my nail polish. You'll get it everywhere. Majid, what's come over you all of a sudden? My father's next door. You're crushing the flowers."
Majid took Sabiha by force. He kissed her lips passionately so that she wouldn't be able to speak. As she whimpered under him, he looked at this jasmine-scented woman and wondered if she had indeed been unfaithful with that doctor.
Oh,
or someone else.
Oh.
He thrust himself again and again deep inside her before finally rolling over.
"Oh, Sabiha," he said.
Majid left the room feeling a bit embarrassed. He walked into the sitting room where Fazl Reshat Pasha was still looking out of the window, waiting for his wife.
"You look a bit tired, Majid," he said, looking over his glasses.
"Yes, it's been a tiring day," Majid replied. "We've had some upsetting developments."
"I'm sorry to hear it. What happened?"
"Our Prime Minister asked for the Foreign Minister's resignation."
"Really? Why's that?"
"Numan Bey was never in favor of siding with the Germans. On the contrary, he always believed if we eventually had to take sides, it should be with the Allies. But apparently he's done exactly the opposite."
"What's that?"
"He's apparently come down on the side of the Germans."
"You mean he changed sides?"
"Frankly, I don't believe Numan Bey would do that. But you see, when the German army pressed against the Bulgarian border, we signed an agreement with them not to intervene. Furthermore, as you know, there's also the question of our chrome."
"What about it? Weren't we supposed to be selling it to the Allies?"
"The agreement we signed with the Allies has expired. Not only have the Germans asked to buy it, but they've also agreed to sign a contract committing themselves to continue buying it until the end of the war. We desperately needed such a contract. Numan Bey was against the Germans, but he wasn't against an agreement that would be to our advantage. He believes that nations have no friends or foes. They only have their interests."
"So what happened?"
"Apparently, low-tonnage German ships are being allowed to pass through the Bosphorus without being searched. The Montreux Agreement forbids the searching of commercial vessels. Despite that agreement, the British sent us notes urging us to stop their passage. But Numan Bey was against the decision."
"When did all this happen?"
"Today. Apparently, the British sent another note threatening that they wouldn't sign our economic agreement unless we stopped and searched the ships. Our foreign minister pointed out that his hands were tied by the Montreux Agreement. However, the Prime Minister disagreed and forced him to call the German ambassador, informing him that, from now on, all German ships passing through would be searched. Afterward, he delivered a very harsh speech at the minister's assembly. The ministers were completely taken aback, and when he'd finished his speech, he called for Numan Bey's resignation, which Numan Bey offered there and then."
"Strange. I've been listening to the radio all day and I've heard nothing of this.
I suppose it will all come out this evening. Our foreign minister was strict about sticking to international rules and regulations, and there's also the other side of the coin. Our economic interests, money. Especially these days when our country is in such dire straits. Anyway, I'm still very sorry about Numande. I've gained most of my experience under his wing, and I'll always be grateful to him.
These economic agreements are two-edged swords, Fazul Reshat Pasha said. Nations like ours accept loans like life support, forgetting that when they have to be repaid, it can bring a country to its knees. Wasn't that just what happened to the mighty Ottoman? That aside, who's taking over the foreign ministry?
Nobody has been named as a successor. The Prime Minister will be running the Foreign Ministry himself for a while.
I hope it will be someone you approve of, said the Pasha.
No one cares what I think. I'll simply have to carry on with my duties, serving whoever steps in. The old man got up, switched on the radio, and went back to the window. Sabiha appeared at the end of the hallway carrying the white carnations. She walked into the dining room and picked up a crystal vase from the sideboard. She looked flushed and rather sheepishly avoided looking at her father, saying only,
"Look, father, Majid bought us some flowers."
She walked to the kitchen to fill the vase with water. Fazul Reshat Pasha didn't even hear his daughter. He was concentrating on the road outside, waiting for his wife.
"Where the hell is that woman? It's getting dark already," he grumbled.
"Mother's gone to her dressmaker Fazla Hanum," Sabiha shouted from the kitchen. "I don't think she'll finish early. I bet she's going through every fashion magazine there."
"Why does it have to take so long? It's so dark outside."
"Don't worry, father. Hajar is with her," Sabiha said, walking back into the sitting room with the flowers.
Suddenly the telephone rang, and she rushed into the hall with the vase in her hand. Maji tried to eavesdrop when he heard her gasping, but he couldn't hear what she was saying because of the radio. A while later, Sabiha appeared at the sitting room door. Her cheeks, previously flushed, were as white as the flowers in the vase. She could hardly speak.
"Majid, Tariq's on the phone. Tariq Arudja. He'd like to speak to you. Apparently the Gestapo took Rafo from the pharmacy and put him on a train with some others. They let him go later, as far as I can understand. My poor darling sister, what she must have gone through."
"What's that? What happened?"
Fazul Reshat Pasha asked as Maji jumped forward to catch the vase about to slip from Sabiha's hands. Husband and wife looked at each other but didn't answer.
"What are you hiding from me?" asked the old man. "Don't tell me something's happened to Selva."
This was the first time he had mentioned his daughter's name in years. "Don't you worry about Selva. She knows how to take care of herself," Majid replied.
"Tariq wants to speak to you," said Sabiha.
Majid ran to the phone.
"Who's that, Sabiha? Who's on the phone?"
"It's a friend of ours from Paris, father. He's the consul there. He's got some news."
"What news?"
"I don't know exactly. I'm sure Majid will give us the details."
"What's happened to Selva, then?"
"As Majid said, she knows how to take care of herself. She'll be all right. Don't worry. It seems the Germans got hold of Rafo, but then set him free."
"What about the child?"
"You mean Fazul?"
The old man didn't reply.
"Fazul's all right. Everyone's all right." "Father, your hands are shaking. Please calm down. Mother should be back shortly. Don't let her see you this way. Please relax. Do it for me, please."
When Majid returned, he found Sabiha on her knees next to her father. "Tariq says that the Alfandaris will probably be returning home soon."
"The Alfandaris? You mean Selva?"
"All three of them."
"Who persuaded them to do that?"
"I imagine this latest episode was the last straw."
"When are they coming?"
That's not certain yet. Taruk said probably within a month.
We've got to find them somewhere to live, haven't we? Said Sabiha.
For whom? Asked Fazl Reshat Pasha.
For Selva, father. It seems they are coming back.
There was complete silence. Fazl Reshat Pasha turned away to hide the tears in his eyes. He looked outside into the darkness. On the train. The Gare de l'Est was chaotic. People rushed every which way, changing platforms. There were women dragging children, men trying to catch their trains, porters carrying baggage, confused foreigners, obviously tourists, and most of all, soldiers. Young, innocent-faced men with squeaky boots moved in groups. They were all over the station, going to kill or be killed. People called to each other, some reunited, screaming with joy, others being separated and screaming with anguish. There were the sounds of bells ringing, whistles blowing, train wheels screeching on the rails, and soldiers marching monotonously. And different smells. That distinct smoky smell of wet steam that fills one's nostrils. The whiff of perfume from women passing by. The stench of sweat and garlic permeating the coarse clothes of peasants, and the acrid smell oozing from the bodies of the young soldiers. Hope and grief coexisted in this station. Ferit was running toward the fifth carriage of a very long train, holding his wife's hand tightly with one hand and carrying a rather large suitcase in the other. Two bags hung over his shoulders.
Monsieur, please, monsieur, have a look at this ticket.
The conductor, whose cap came down to his eyebrows, looked at the ticket and grumbled.
What are you doing here, monsieur? Your platform is on the other side. Go down those stairs and across.
Ferit turned around, dragging his wife by the hand.
Wait, Ferit, let go of my hand. You'll make me fall,
complained Evelyn.
I can't do that, darling. Can't you see how crowded this place is? If I let go of your hand and lose you, I'll never be able to find you again. Please try to keep up.
They ran down the stairs hand in hand, across and up the next flight of stairs, and along the platform of another long train with steam coming out of the engine. Ferit noticed someone tall in the crowd who he thought looked like Raphael. He heaved a sigh of relief and slowed down. Ferit showed his ticket to another official standing by the door of a carriage.
That one, farther along, he said, pointing.
They carried on walking. The difficult moment was approaching. It was Ferit's duty to sort out the seating arrangements for the passengers, and he needed to get to the carriage quickly. Ferit had been at the station overnight and met up with Evelyn early in the morning. Hikmet Özduan and Taruk had come to the station to take over the carriage and deal with the necessary formalities. The carriage had been connected to the very end of a train leaving for Berlin at 9 o'clock in the morning. After completing the formalities, Hikmet Özduan left to go home. Ferit and Taruk decided to go into one of the all-night cafes and order coffee and cognac. Taruk was deep in thought.
Don't forget, Ferit, he had said. It's very important that the garrison at the Turkish border is notified of your arrival in advance. Our officials in Bulgaria are supposed to let them know that you are on your way. I just hope that nothing goes wrong.
Everything will be fine, my friend. Don't worry. I don't see your problem.
The timing is very important. While you're crossing the border, the garrison there will be having a soccer match with a neighboring garrison.
Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. Such are the sensitive intricacies of diplomacy. It's absolutely vital that the soldiers at the border have no knowledge of your crossing. God forbid someone could spot something wrong with those passports, but if they are busy playing soccer, no one will notice anything.
Phew! Why all these precautions?
The Germans, of course. Do you think it's easy to flirt with the British and protect the Jews while making sure the Germans don't turn against us?
Of course not. I do understand, my friend. May Allah be with you, Ferit said. Is there anything I can do to alert our garrison at the border?
I don't think so.
Your calling our embassy might be risky. We'll try and sort it out with our colleagues in Bulgaria. They sat side by side drinking coffee and cognac, one after another, without talking much. Their friendship was relatively new, but they felt comfortable with each other, sharing their anxiety about the adventure ahead. Eventually, Taruk left Ferit alone with his thoughts. He saw his colorful and exciting early life flash before his eyes like the cascades of a waterfall. Ferit had earned the nickname Smartass while studying at the Galatasaray Lycée in Istanbul. Memories flashing through his mind revealed why he had earned the name. His life was full of successes and obsessions. He could turn his mind to anything, theater, music, law, mathematics. As well as academic success, he had turned his attention to fighting for causes that he believed in. All this came to his mind now in this dirty cafe in Paris. He'd been studying in Paris in 1940 when Hitler invaded France, and the Turkish government ordered all Turks to return. Because the war was waged by this lunatic, he had joined the secret resistance organization to fight for humanity. No one knew how much longer all this would go on. The only sure thing was that he would be on the train bound for Berlin tomorrow. He had reached a point of no return, and everything crowded in on him at once. As if this wasn't enough, he stood waiting at the station for Evelyn to arrive, worrying how he was going to explain to her that they would be traveling in separate carriages. When they reached carriage number 5, Ferit helped Evelyn on board before lifting up the suitcase. Then he got on board himself. Inching their way along the narrow corridor, they looked at the compartment numbers.
"Here it is," said Ferit. "Look, you've got a window seat. Isn't that nice?"
The rest of the compartment was still empty.
"I still don't understand why we have to go to Istanbul through Berlin," Evelyn said.
"How many times do I have to tell you? Beggars can't be choosers," Ferit replied, putting the suitcase on the luggage rack and the shoulder bag on the seat beside his wife.
"Are you sitting next to me? It would be more comfortable if you sat opposite and we could stretch our legs out."
Ferit pretended to check his ticket.
"Actually, it seems I'm not sitting in this compartment."
"What?"
"Unbelievably, I've been allocated a seat in a different compartment."
"Why?"
"You're right to get angry, Evelyn. I'm angry too, but there is nothing we can do."
"I bet you already knew this."
"Well, you see, my sweetheart, when I went to pick up the tickets, the train was almost full. They could only offer me seats in separate carriages. I promise you, I tried my best to get seats together. I even explained that my wife is pregnant. They promised to do all they could, but obviously that wasn't possible."
Evelyn raised her voice.
"I can't believe this! I'm to travel all the way to Istanbul on my own, and you've accepted it! Is that it?"
"Shh! Please don't shout, darling. People are looking at us."
"I couldn't care less. Get that suitcase down."
Evelyn got up from her seat and tried to reach the suitcase.
"Stop it, Evelyn. Are you going mad?"
"Either we travel together or not at all. That's final."
"Darling, please sit down. If you insist on leaving your seat, someone else may take it, and you'll lose the window seat."
"Look at all these people. Look."
Ferit lowered the window and pulled his wife over.
"Just look at these thousands of people all struggling to get seats on trains. Can you imagine how many of them will have to travel standing up in the corridors? I managed to get you a seat and by the window, and yet all you can do is moan. There's gratitude for you. So what if we can't sit next to each other?"
"I only don't understand why we're traveling all the way separately when you supposedly reserved these seats so long ago."
"Okay, you just sit there like the good girl I know you are and I'll go and find my seat. You never know, maybe we can swap seats with someone."
"What if we can't?"
"In that case, we'll just have to make do with what we've got. If we can't sit together, I promise to come and see you every time we stop."
Evelyn was going to object again, but then some people came into the compartment. She looked like she was close to tears.
Please, Evelyn, be reasonable. Darling, just let me go and find my carriage. I promise to do all I can. For God's sake, don't leave your seat. I'll be back as soon as possible.
Ferit left the compartment, got out of the carriage with his bag on his shoulder, and started walking toward the end of the train. Evelyn got up and leaned out of the open window and watched her husband. He stopped beside a carriage some distance away. Evelyn saw him talking to a tall man.
"Would you mind closing the window, madame? It's getting rather cold,"
said an elderly lady who had settled opposite her. Evelyn pulled away from the window and looked at the woman with tearful eyes.
"Allow me," said a young man who had just come into the compartment.
He closed the window. Evelyn pressed her head against the window pane. She could no longer see where Ferit was. She took a newspaper out of her bag to try to alleviate her stress. The compartment gradually filled up. Ferit was right. Seats were scarce. The family sitting opposite had three children, but they only had two seats. Obviously, they intended to sit the children on their laps. Ferit returned while Evelyn was doing the crossword. He no longer had his shoulder bag with him.
"What happened? Are we swapping seats?" she asked.
"Very difficult. I'm in a second-class carriage. It isn't as comfortable as yours."
Evelyn looked around as if to say, "You call this comfortable?"
"No one from here would agree to swap places with me."
"I will,"
replied Evelyn.
"We could ask someone in your carriage to exchange his seat for mine by the window."
"You think I hadn't thought of that? But there are no single people in my compartment. They are all couples or families."
"So what are we to do?"
Evelyn asked with tears in her eyes.
"We will have to put up with the situation, my sweetheart. You never know. Someone may get off. We'll just have to wait and see. Would you like me to get you something? Another newspaper, a magazine, cigarettes, sweets?"
"No, thanks."
"Water?"
"Don't try to get around me."
"Evelyn, please don't give me that sad look. I promise I'll come see you at every stop."
Ferit bent down to kiss his wife. As he was leaving, he turned to an elderly gentleman sitting beside her and asked him to keep an eye on his wife.
"Is there really a difference of class in this mayhem?"
said the man, indicating the crowded compartment.
"Rest assured, young man, I'll take care of your wife."
Ferit pushed his way through the packed corridor with difficulty and jumped out, running all the way to the last carriage. They had filled the compartments of this special carriage brought over from Turkey with people holding Turkish passports. Ferit found his way to the compartment where he had left his passport in his bag. Selva had seated Samuel and Perla side by side next to the window. Fazıl was sitting on Perla's lap looking out. When he saw Ferit, he clapped his hands with joy.
"Hi, little man," said Ferit. "Did you look after my bag?"
"Where's your wife?"
asked Selva.
"Where is she sitting?"
"She's in another carriage."
"How come?"
"She doesn't know about this carriage. All she knows is that we are going to Istanbul via Berlin, that's all."
"I don't understand."
"Selva, Evelyn is expecting a baby. She had a hemorrhage when she was only 2 months on. I didn't tell her anything because I didn't want to cause her any more anxiety than necessary. She has no idea about this carriage."
"But is she to travel such a long way on her own?"
"There are some nice people in her compartment, and she has a perfectly valid passport. She might get bored, but that's nothing compared to other possibilities."
"You mean that we might not reach our destination?"
"You know we are all taking a gamble. I told you so many times, didn't I? In fact, I insisted that you and Fazıl should travel with regular passengers, just like Evelyn. Both your husband and Tarık begged you, but you wouldn't listen. You're very stubborn, you know."
"I realize that."
"In that case, please don't ask me questions I can't answer. Where's Raphael?"
"He went to the pharmacy next to the station to buy a few things we seem to have forgotten."
"I'm going to check who's sitting in which compartment. Don't forget that you, Raphael, and I have to split up the way we discussed."
I know. How many people should sit here?
Well, in normal circumstances, only 3 on each side, but there are 9 even in Evelyn's compartment. When I'm organizing the seats, I'll try not to crowd you in.
No, that's not the reason. Don't think about it, Selva said.
All those staying in Ferit's apartment had become very close friends, especially during their last night together. When Ferit announced to them that they would be leaving the following morning, no one seemed very pleased, despite having waited for the news for some time. They must have been embarking on the longest and most difficult journey of their lives. Either they would make it to their destination or not. Each of them had been quiet, eating their cheese and lettuce baguettes and drinking their wine. Undoubtedly, they all had the same apprehension in their hearts. They might be traveling into the unknown, but they had each other for support. Outside, Taruk was moving along the compartments, carrying a paper bag and peering through each window, one by one. When he saw Evelyn's profile, he stopped and tapped on the window. Startled, she turned around and looked out. Her eyes lit up when she saw Taruk. Because of the station noises, she couldn't hear him say, "I'm coming in," but she read his lips. She got up and met him in the corridor, and they put their arms around each other.
"Is your seat comfortable?" asked Taruk. "Yes, but you know what that crafty husband of mine did?" "Yes, Evelyn, but I can assure you it wasn't his fault. He's upset about it, too. I spoke to the conductor myself earlier, and he promised he'd let us know if there should be an available seat. Don't worry too much. The important thing is to have a safe journey," Taruk said, avoiding her eyes.
"At least you're safe in here. There's no way of knowing where Ferit's carriage will end up."
"I'm so worried, Taruk," she said. "I don't understand why this train is going through Berlin."
"Apparently some of the other lines have been bombed. This sort of thing happens in wartime. Anyway, look what I got for you."
Taruk took some chocolates and biscuits out of the bag and gave them to Evelyn.
"Oh, Taruk, you're such a good friend. Thank you for coming to see us off."
"I couldn't let you go without saying goodbye."
"We could have seen each other earlier, but Ferit wouldn't allow me to come to Paris until the last moment. I'm sure you know that rascal let our apartment, don't you?"
"I do, but wasn't that great? At least you'll have some money coming in each month."
Taruk insisted on helping her back to her seat.
"Don't tire yourself, relax, and have a safe journey," he said, leaving her.
Taruk walked all the way back to the carriage with the star and crescent emblem on the windows and found Margot in the same compartment as Selva.
"You're traveling in this compartment?" he asked.
"Yes, Selva and I will be together. Raphael's in another compartment," Margot replied.
She seemed much calmer than she had been a few hours earlier. After Taruk had left Ferit at the station cafe, he had rushed home to have a shave and change his clothes before seeing Margot off. Margot already had her suitcase packed and was ready by the door. She was wearing a gray 2-piece suit and her favorite hat. Taruk had been surprised to find her sitting bolt upright on a chair that she had pulled next to the window.
"What on earth are you doing all dressed and ready to go at this time of the morning?"
"I've been ready since midnight. I waited for a while in case you came over, but when you didn't, I decided to get myself ready for the journey. There was no way I was going to sleep anyway."
"Margot, there were some important things I had to discuss with Ferit."
I know, my darling. Thank you for coming.
Why don't you make us a cup of coffee?"
The coffee smelled so good. They wrapped themselves in each other's arms and drank their coffee without speaking. Later, Margot put her red coat around her shoulders. They went to the station together in Taruk's car, and after Taruk saw her to the carriage, he left to get a few things for her journey.
"Margot, I haven't been able to get you what I really wanted. Some of the stores aren't even open yet. But I did get loads of magazines and newspapers for you to read on the way. I also picked up a few things for you in case you get hungry. Just what was available, of course."
He emptied most of the contents of the paper bag onto the seat next to Margot.
You shouldn't have gone to all this trouble, said Selva. I've got enough to feed the world and his wife.
Finally, Taruk took out a package from the bottom of the bag and gave it to little Fazul.
And this is for you to play with, my little friend.
Fazul immediately tore open the package. It was a wooden train.
Goodness me, Taruk! How did you manage to find a toy store open at the crack of dawn?
That was a present I bought earlier. Same as this one, he said, taking another parcel from the bag and offering it to Margot. Margot unwrapped her gift very carefully. It was a framed photograph of the two of them Raphael had taken with her camera, one sunny morning at La Closerie des Lilas. She looked at it, remembering how happy they had been that day. Taruk had his arms around her, and their eyes were sparkling with joy. Margot pressed the frame to her heart. Suddenly, Ferit appeared at the door with a tall, well-dressed man.
"This is Monsieur Broad," he said. "He used to be the general manager of the German bank in Turkey. He is now working for the immigration department and has spent a lot of time and effort to make this journey possible. He traveled all the way here to deliver this carriage personally, and he wants to wish you a pleasant journey. Particularly you, Selva." Selva was surprised. She stood up and shook the man's hand. Then Ferit introduced him to the others. "This is Margot Palais and Samuel and Perla Afnaim. In other words, Sami and Peri Naim."
The man shook everyone's hands and wished them a pleasant journey. Then he turned to Selva again.
"Young lady, I had the honor of meeting your father in Istanbul."
"Really? When?"
"Just before traveling here. He was very concerned about you, and he came to see me. I promised I would make sure to see you if you were on this train."
Selva couldn't believe her ears. Her heart beat crazily, and her ears began to buzz.
"This is incredible! You mean you actually met my father?"
"That's right, just before coming here. He visited me at the immigration department's office in Karaköy. He inquired specifically about this train. You probably know that our department depends entirely on public support. Your father made a very generous donation to us, for which we are extremely grateful."
Selva heard nothing but the buzzing in her ears. She wanted to cry, but she bit her lip and averted her eyes, trying to stop the tears from running down her cheeks. Ferit and Monsieur Broad left, and an elderly man walked in, trying to squeeze a rather large suitcase and briefcase onto the luggage rack.
"I'm sorry, monsieur. This suitcase will have to go in the baggage compartment,"
said a conductor passing by.
"Why didn't you leave it there before getting on?"
The man didn't argue. He left his briefcase on his seat and walked out with the suitcase.
"I think I know that man. Where did I see him before?"
muttered Margot. Selva, who was watching her husband return with some parcels, said,
"Search me. I don't know him."
Raphael walked in and Taruk stood up.
"It's time for me to say goodbye. If I don't get off now, I might end up having to travel with you," he said.
The noise of the engine getting up steam could be heard, but there were so many trains and whistles it was difficult to separate one from another. While Taruk stood, another group of people gathered in the doorway. Constance and Marcel, who'd been taught by Selva in Paris. A tall young man and another elderly man walked into the compartment. Selva and Taruk hugged each other. Taruk kissed Fazul on the forehead as he played with his train on the floor, and he wished Samuel and Perla a pleasant journey. He nodded goodbye to the others and stepped into the corridor. Margot followed him. She hugged Taruk tightly as the train slowly began to move.
"I'll always remember you, Margot," Taruk said, jumping off the train.
He bumped into Ferit, who was running back after visiting his wife. He was out of breath and just managed to shake Taruk's hand firmly before stepping on the train.
"Take care of yourself, and thanks for everything,"
he shouted as the train pulled away. As the train gathered speed, Margot lowered the window and leaned out, waving goodbye to Taruk with her handkerchief. Selva, Rafo, Perla, and Samuel crushed her against the window, trying to do the same. Ferit, who was still standing on the running board, waved. The tall young man was also waving to someone. Tarek caught a brief glimpse of Margot's sad face as the train passed by him. He stood there, his hand held high as the train moved farther and farther away, becoming smaller and smaller in the distance until it finally disappeared in a cloud of engine smoke. The train. Margot could no longer see Taruk's silhouette in the distance, so she sat down, closed her eyes, and pretended to sleep to avoid talking to anyone. Just as the train approached Reims, she opened her eyes and again noticed the elderly man sitting opposite her. She certainly knew that face. She was sure she'd seen him before. He hadn't removed his cap like the other elderly gentleman in the compartment. He was wearing glasses and reading a book. Perla and Samuel were playing a game of battleships together. Because she had been up the whole night, Selva had fallen asleep with her son on her lap. The compartment was quiet. Margot hoped this peace and quiet would continue. She felt like she had no expectations anymore. She couldn't return to her own country because it was run by the Nazis. Her whole family was scattered. She had been forced to leave her job and the man she had begun to love. She wished she could go on traveling on this train as long as the world turned. Clickety-clack, clickety-clack.
"Would you like a cigarette, mademoiselle?"
Margot almost jumped out of her seat.
"No, thank you."
"Do you mind if I do?"
"No, not at all," she said.
The young man was sitting right beside her. He was well-groomed, clean, but extremely thin. The skin under his eyes was purple. Margot hoped he didn't have tuberculosis.
"Are you going to Berlin?"
He was a chatterbox, and all Margot wanted was to be left in peace. She wished this bag of bones would talk to someone else.
"No, I'm going farther," she replied.
"To Prague?"
She didn't reply and pulled out a Hungarian book to read.
"What language is that?"
"Hungarian."
"So you must be Hungarian."
"Yes,"
Margot replied, burying herself in her book.
"I'm sorry to disturb you. It's just that I miss talking."
It was Margot's turn to feel sorry. She wondered what had happened to him.
"There's nothing to forgive," she said. "It's just that I'm rather unhappy about having to leave Paris. On top of that, I'm tired." "Where are you going?"
"To Istanbul. That's of course, if we get there."
"Really?
Why are you surprised? Is that such a long way to be going?"
"That's where I'm going too," replied Margot.
"So we'll be together for some time."
"I'm David, by the way," the skinny young man said. "David Russo."
The train was passing through pretty green valleys, past the gardens of suburban houses with children playing and dogs jumping around. Women were hanging out their wash and men were mowing the lawns. They traveled through towns and cities, too, where one could see the domes of churches in the distance. Looking at all this, one had the impression that all was well with the world. If an alien visiting Earth for the first time were on this train, he'd have the same impression. Europe's hell wasn't visible from the train's windows. The passengers in the compartment, apart from the children playing, were either reading, looking at the passing view, or having a nap. They weren't talking. Their hearts were heavy. The children were busy asking each other history and geography questions, one after the other. Selva woke up, but she didn't dare move in case she disturbed Fazl, who was still sleeping on her lap. Raphael had come and gone twice to check on his wife and son while they were asleep, and Margot had made signs to him that everything was fine.
"How high is Mount Everest?"
Perla asked.
7,500 meters.
"Right. What separates Europe from Asia?"
As Samuel was about to answer, the man in the cap spoke for the first time since he had gotten on the train.
"Your previous answer was incorrect, young man."
"Which?"
asked Samuel.
The height of Mount Everest is 8,848 meters, not 7,500.
How do you know that?
I just do.
Margot moved uneasily in her seat. Not only did she know the face, but she recognized the voice, too.